First case on our calendar is 96-27-27, the matter of the estate of Michael Boffman, deceased. Mr. Cash. You may proceed to argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I have a prepared argument of approximately 7 minutes, which I would like to give and answer questions and hopefully reserve a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, I should warn you that sometimes we interrupt the counsel during their argument, so be prepared. Okay.
Like, for instance, doesn't your client really owe this money?
Yes.
Okay.
The facts giving rise to this appeal are as follows. On October 24, Provident Bank filed suit in the Warren County Probate Court against Albert Cash, executor of the estate of Michael Boffman. Mr. Boffman had signed the guarantee of a note, or the loan from the bank to Riverport Enterprises. In early 94, Riverport fell behind in the payments, prompting the bank to write two letters of March 10, 1994. The first March 10 letter was sent to Riverport, and it told Riverport that they were in default. If the default was not cured by March 18, then the entire amount of the loan would come due and going. Also on March 10, the bank wrote to the executor, enclosed a copy of its March 10 letter to Riverport, and notified the executor that if Riverport's defaults or deficiencies were not cured by March 18, that letter would constitute a demand on the executor to remit payments immediately. On March 21, the bank wrote to the executor, told him that the payments demanded in this March 10 letter had not been made, and demanding that the executor immediately remit the payment and pay the amount of its guarantee. The bank then filed a second amended claim of creditors, attaching to it copies of these letters of March 10 and March 21.
Counsel, does an executor have the power to make a contract?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And if an executor makes a contract on behalf of the estate, is that contract an invalid contract?
Yes, Your Honor.
You make a claim in your brief that the Court of Appeals throughout the contract that the executor made.
Throughout.
Or nullified it or said it wasn't valid or something. What's your position on it?
You're talking about the addendum.
I'm talking about the addendum.
Okay.
Is that a contract? Do you accept the contract?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
Okay.
And the response to that is that at the time that contract was entered into, there are various aspects of it. But at that point in time, by admission of the bank, by admission of all parties, by finding of the Court of Appeals, this issue is not before this court, the claim of the bank against the estate was contingent.
Okay, if I could interrupt you a second. The Court of Appeals held, now quote, the claim which appellant initially asserted was contingent, premature, and ineffective. That's what you referred to. However, that did not say the contract that the addendum was ineffective. It says the claim, correct?
You agree with that? The claim is the contract. The contract gives rise to the claim.
Not necessarily, because then on the last page of the opinion, the court says that the request for payment is consistent with the guarantee as modified by the addendum. That seems to imply that the court's honoring the contract.
No. The claim.
You seem to mix up the contract and the claim, but the Court of Appeals seems to separate the two, and the claim was re-presented, was it not?
It was presented after it accrued.
Right.
No claim existed against the estate at the time the addendum was signed.
But the contract existed.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The contract did exist.
Whether we call it a claim or a contract, or whatever, did not the executor, after all of this was going on, clearly sign and enter into a new guarantee agreement on behalf of the estate, and in fact even got additional money?
I don't think it was a new contract. If you look at the addendum, Your Honor, you will find stated therein, it states that the bank after the addendum was executed, had no better claims against the estate than it had when Mr. Bobbitt died.
Okay, so let's not call it a new contract, let's call it a...
The same thing.
A subsequent...
Yeah.
Addendum, but it is an addendum to the contract, and wasn't that a guarantee of the loan? That's what it says.
It reaffirms the guarantee, yes, it doesn't alter it, it changes the amount.
And in addition to that, the estate, or the executor in this case, got additional money at that time.
The executor got nothing, the executor put money in to the marina, and also...
Wasn't the amount of the loan increased?
No, it's decreased. The guarantee was reduced from $1.8 million to $1,650,000.
But there was a quid pro quo. The guarantee, the amount that the executor was now on the hook for was less because the executor made the payment.
Right. And then it reaffirmed the guarantee.
So there is the consideration for the addendum that the executor executed.
That's what I was getting at.
But it specifically granted no greater rights against the estate that existed at the time of Mr. Waffman's death. And at the time of his death, the bank had no right against the guarantor because it was a contingent claim, i.e. a claim that did not exist and would never exist unless there was a default. That's the definition of contingent claim. Proceeding on, the trial court dismissed this case because it found, number one, that the bank's claims, as admitted against the estate, were contingent until March 18th, that the claims were rejected by the executor, as a result of which the trial court, the probate court, lacked jurisdiction.
Mr. Cash, you acknowledge in your brief that the case law requires that the rejection be unequivocal and plain. And then I'm having a hard time with the position that the rejection here was plain and unequivocal when it was by inaction.
Well, Your Honor, the statute specifically states that when a demand for allowance is made,
right,
silence is a rejection.
Well, it's true. It does with certain, I mean, that's the whole argument here, but that statute is triggered. Whether or not triggering that statute requires at least some of the elements there, whether it be use of the word allowance, whether it be reference to the statute, whether it be the 5 days, or perhaps not all of those, but some. In this case, we have any. We don't have in the triggering by the bank, the demand for payment. Do you have any of those?
The demand for payment was for immediate payment.
Yes.
And we believe that the rejection, the silence, constituted a rejection 5 days from the receipt of that letter. The letter was received on March 23, and that this claim was rejected on March 28 pursuant to revised code. Now,
the 5 days isn't mentioned, of course, in the demand.
Well, there are cases, we have cited cases on our brief that the demand need not mention the statute, it need not mention the 5 days. All it has to do is communicate that the demand is really being made.
In each of those cases, would you acknowledge that in each of those cases, at least there was something in each case, there was either a 5 day. There was use of the word reject, allow, or one of those words. Or I don't see one case like this one that has nothing.
I don't recall offhand because a lot were cited.
Yes.
But the case that I would rely on is this court's decision in 1903 in the Miller versus Ewing case. And I think that's a very important case. Learned counsel for the bank wants to say that's a different factual situation, etc. I submit that it is not.
It certainly doesn't involve this statute.
No, it does not, but it involves the same issue, and the issue in this case, very simply, we should not get away from that, is does a demand for a payment of necessity include a demand for allowance? And that is precisely what the Miller case says. And although there were facts in the Miller case, the court states, and I'd like to point that out, what was an issue in Miller. And I want to quote the court on page 182 of the Ohio Citation 68, OS 182. The contention on the part of the plaintiff in error is that, giving to the statute its proper construction, there is no evidence tending to support the jury's finding because it does not appear that the creditor exhibited his claim for the purpose of having it allowed. States the issue on the next page, 183, and says, it is insisted that in order to answer the requirements of the exhibition of the claim to the administrator, it must be shown that the creditor presented it for the distinct purpose of an allowance. In other words, the court is looking at facts, it's looking at law. If this be so, then it is not within the power of the administrator to reject until after the creditor has made such presentation. And two sentences later, the court disposes of this legal argument and says, there should be no technical construction given to the matter of exhibiting the claim. If the facts show that the parties understand that the claim is presented, then it's exhibited. And where a creditor produces his claim in a shape to sufficiently apprise the administrator of the nature and asks pay upon it in whole or in part, immediately or in a short time, surely it must follow that he has presented it for allowance. An administrator may allow without paying, but in the nature of things, he cannot pay without allowing. So that even if the proposition that there is not an exhibition of the claim unless it is presented for the distinct purpose of allowance be sound, yet it does not apply to this case.
Counsel, there are two, and I understand that there are two ways to present your claim. You have an estate open, you have your window of when everybody presents their claim. And in that window, the executor is supposed to plainly and unequivocally reject, correct? Or else it's automatically allowed. Is that correct? Is that your understanding of the issue?
Well, the claim is presented, and the letter is presented. The executor may allow, it may reject, or it may do nothing.
But if it does nothing,
then
it's allowed.
No.
Under that early stage of presentation. If the executor doesn't reject your claim, it's allowed under the early stages of presentation of claims to the state, is it not?
That was not my understanding.
But that case, you just read it. You can have allowance without payment.
Can't have payment without allowance. You can't get a divorce unless it's the person who married.
Well, there was no payment.
There was no payment, and there was silence.
Let's stay with that for a minute. Because you want us to take this as a rejection.
Yes.
We need to say it's rejection by silence.
Yes.
And the only basis for saying that is that there was no action for the demand for payment, which didn't include any words of allow or reject or reference to the statute.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the Miller-Ewing and the Barnett case of necessity, they say that a demand for payment is a demand for allowance. It's both at the same time.
But the General Assembly seems to think that we should have some sort of due process in this, and so they said, okay, we need to move these things along. Creditors need to know, and they need to be able to have their rejections and move along more.
Well, you're
for the state to establish what they're going to pay and what they won't. If they said, well, we're going to handle this a certain way, didn't they?
I think what we're trying to do, what the essence of this is communication
yeah.
between a creditor and an executor.
And you need to be plain and unequivocal. I'm just having a hard time. What's more plain and unequivocal than the executor having taken any hand upon having received that demand for payment and plainly and unequivocally reject?
That would be a rejection.
But there would be a reason for those creditors to, if you equivocate, you might be able to lay them in, and then they'll forget. I mean, they won't realize it's a rejection and they won't file suit.
But Your Honor, let me point out, number one, that you would then eliminate the statute that says that silence constitutes a rejection, number one. Number two, in this particular case, the bank wrote the letters. And I think just logic dictates that when you say pay, you have to allow it because you can't pay. Now, the bank wrote the letter. If it didn't intend,
well, we had a lot of letters to say pay, pay. But well, allow is a special term, isn't it? It's a term of art. Reject and allow is a term of art within this context.
Yeah. But the bank. I would like to point out the facts. The court, the trial court, determined factually that there was a rejection. In this particular case, there's testimony by the executor that he considered the demand letter of March 21 to be a demand and also to be a demand for an allowance, and that he intended his silence to be a rejection.
Let me stop you there. We know what the facts are. What's your response to the bank's argument that the letter that the executor here received was one of several letters they sent apparently to other guarantors, four of the letters to other guarantors? It's the same, I take it's the same letter, and those letters were not letters to an executor under 2117. What's your response to that? That the bank, the executor here got essentially a form letter or a standard letter that the bank sent to guarantors, which doesn't look like a letter pursuant to the statute. What's your response to their argument?
Well, my response is that these letters, first of all, the other people were not dead, so there was no involvement with the 2117 of the revised code. But my response is that, again, I come back to the demand for payment is a demand for an allowance. And the bank is a big boy. They handle estates, or perhaps probably more knowledgeable in probate law than the average executor. And they chose the letter. Now, had they not wished this March 21 letter to be a demand for allowance, then why didn't it say so? Why didn't they say that this letter being written is not to be construed as a demand pursuant to Chapter 2117 of the revised code?
Well, if it was a demand for allowance, why didn't they say so, pursuant to the statute?
I don't know.
If
I think clearly it is. From the Miller case, and again from Scott v. Ewing. Scott v. Barnett, excuse me, the demand was for rings. Give me two rings in 10 days. And the executrix didn't respond. And the trial court determined, as a matter of fact, that that was a rejection by silence. And this court, that case went up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did not touch that finding.
Let me try one more time with the modified guarantee agreement.
Okay.
It was $1,000,008 that was owed.
Yes, sir.
It was $1,650,000 that they, because the executive put $150,000 into the project.
Yes.
So on that date, when you get the agreed modified guarantee, it says in part, the executor acknowledges that the claim of lender against the estate under the documents and so forth for $1,000,008 has been validly and sufficiently presented to the executor, and claim is hereby allowed. How much clearer can that be, whether whatever the case law says, whether it's a claim, whether these letters have any significance? Here you have an executor of the estate clearly executing a guarantee agreement with that language in that says the claim is presented and it's accepted. How do we ignore that?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I don't think you should. But that issue, number one, I don't think is before this court, although obviously you can make it so. The Court of Appeals had actually adopted the Portage County Court of Appeals decision, Morris versus Continental Insurance Company, which held that a contingent claim cannot be presented. A contingent claim cannot be allowed if it's all
I understand. I understand all of those facts. All those words. Didn't your executor sign that guarantee agreement?
Yes, it did.
And didn't it contain that language?
Yes, it did. And that language is put in there by the bank to cover any contingencies that might be there. As a matter of fact, and as a matter of law, the parties agree. The bank says that in its second amended claim that the claim was contingent until March 18th.
Can you answer my question? Thank you.
You've used your time, Mr. Cash. Thank you.
Please.
You've used your time. Mr. Burke?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm pleased to report James Burke for plaintiff athlete Providence Bank. In 1988, Providence Bank made a loan to businesses, Mr. Boswell's involved in good faith. They loaned $7.2 million, based in part and in reliance upon Mr. Boswell's guarantee. It's a good faith transaction. Arm's length. Valid. There's absolutely nothing that has ever called that transaction into question. The issue before this court, as Justice Douglas focused on there at the end, is whether an executor can sign a contract saying that that guarantee claim, which at that point had been presented to this estate, is valid, timely, sufficiently presented, in complete compliance with 2117 of the Ohio Revised Code, and expressly allowed. That's in writing. And then subsequently take the position that they can reverse themselves, renege on the contract, reject the claim, and impair that creditor's rights without ever giving any notice of that complete change of position.
Counsel, assuming that we take the position that this was a contingent claim that had to be represented, you in fact represented the time.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We represented as soon as the contingency was removed.
And the real distinction, the real fight that we seem to be having is whether this representation was similar to initial presentations that are made in the state that have to be clearly and unequivocally rejected, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Versus whether you trigger the creditor's statute that says, I need to do something right away, so let me know within 5 days. Is that what...
That essentially is the issue. At the time that claim became non-contingent, again, we're dealing with the state of facts at that point in time where the executor signed a contract that this guaranteed claim, based upon the amended document, is allowed.
And
at that point in time...
And the case law, as I understand it, seems to say that when you make your initial presentations, silence is not effective for rejection.
Absolutely.
Silence is effective for acceptance.
What it is, Your Honor, is, I think it's 2117.06. Any person whose claim has been presented and not rejected is a creditor of the estate. It's the rejection that's cast out on them. So if a claim is presented and nothing happens and there's silence, it becomes a claim of the estate. It must be rejected. And that's the whole point for why this portion of the statute was enacted. Because if I present a claim to an executor and the executor does nothing, I cannot thereafter go after and enforce my claim. I cannot, but I can, however, force a rejection by doing the second provision of 2117.11, saying, I hereby demand that you allow my claim within 5 days. If he does nothing, that is a sufficient constructive rejection for me to go forward and bring my action to court.
Well, what does all that have to do with anything, given the subsequent addendum that is clear, unequivocal on its face?
In my opinion, it's nothing. I mean, my point, Your Honor, is this is not a game. This is a statutory scheme. And if there is one immutable principle in the Ohio Probate Code, it's because of the draconian statutes of limitations. You must take action within 2 months or you're out. From 1903, they said that these rejections must be plain and unequivocal. We submit that if you have one of these constructive rejections by silence, they also must be plain and unequivocal. When you have an express written contract that allows this claim that never is retracted, the one thing you can read the executive brief over and over and over and never find an answer to is, if in fact, as he now claims, you made some decision to retract this claim or reject the claim after signing a contract that permitted it, why didn't you then not have the decency to honestly, openly write a letter to communicate that? To write a letter to us saying, by the way, I've changed my mind. Your claim is now rejected.
Sir, do you argue that although the Court of Appeals did not decide this case based on that, the addendum that said we allow, instead based it on the silence by rejection wasn't triggered. Do you, is it your client's position that you win on either basis?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You don't need both.
You don't need both. I mean, it seems to me that the court in no sense, the court didn't draw the distinction that Justice Rapp did. And frankly, I think they're wrong. Because 21-1706 specifically provides for the presentation of contingent claims. And the case is much yielded to the statute. It permits that. The court was wrong, frankly, when it said a contingent claim presented early is a nullity. However, we re-presented it here after the time that the claim arose.
And got a signed agreement.
Well, we got a signed agreement. I think what the court was saying is, to trigger this rejection by silence, again, something must show that there was an attempt to invoke this statutory scheme. That contract has never been rescinded. That contract is out there. And with that contract in the record, how can you possibly say that we should have known when we say, please pay the claim that you previously have allowed, that this is somehow going to restart this whole process or wipe out that whole contract? It makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense. Miller versus Ewing is a key case. What Miller versus Ewing says, because they talked about the plain and unequivocal statute at 186, says if a rejection is ambiguous, or if at the time of the alleged rejection the administrator does or says anything from which the claimant may reasonably infer that the determination to dispute or reject the claim is not final, but that it will be further examined or considered, the administrator may not set up such a dispute as a rejection. With an express written contract signed by this executor saying, you must do nothing further, this claim has been allowed. The Court of Appeals essentially said, this communication cannot have been written. It could not have been intended. Every single case, there's not a single case, by the way, that has been cited by anybody that deals with an executor who signed a contract allowing a claim and then claim that they're rejected by silence. There's nothing that promotes that, which is why this is such a narrow case, and why, frankly, I think it's one that really has no broad implications for Ohio law or the Ohio probate code. They went farther in this case, and they said this claim was allowed. It wasn't like the equivocation you see in Fox Hospital versus Holly case, where, well, I think it's rejected, but let's have a hearing on it. They expressly allowed it. The notice sent out, as Justice Boyer indicated, was a notice sent to everybody. It's all been guaranteed. There was nothing about it that said this is pursuant to 21-1711. This is about an allowance of a claim.
That might not be terribly significant if we didn't have the allowance of the claim here, but it's your argument, I take it, that the claim was allowed in 1994, I guess it was in 1992, rather, and that when you sent a letter to the executor, the same letter you sent to the other guarantors, that you were simply requesting that guarantor to make good on its contract.
Once the claim has been allowed, it is within the jurisdiction of the probate court. You enforce that in the probate court. If it is rejected, you take the opposite path and you go to the court of common pleas. What we did is we said, please pay on the claim you allowed 2 years ago, because now the corporation has defaulted. It's time for payment. And that it said nothing about allowance, it said nothing about 5 days, it said nothing about a statute. Absolutely nothing. That's precisely what the Court of Appeals said. You might not have to do all three of those, but you certainly, as Justice Cook said, you have to do something that indicates you're within the purview of the statute. And it's entirely logical that the bank did nothing because they had a signed written contract. This is permissible. Your Honor, I think in conclusion, we don't be candid here. The executor is trying to use the statute to evade a claim that he expressly contracted to bring about and permitted and finally prevented. There is no explanation for why they would not communicate change of position to try to be legitimately, honestly, fairly forthright about a change of position. There is no public policy that authorizes the executive to try to dupe a creditor or to try to renege on a bank contract. We think that this is a very narrow case. We think the Court of Appeals correctly decided it, both under 21-17 and because, in view of this contract, there could be no clear and unequivocal rejection. In the event the Court fails to uphold what the Court of Appeals decided, there will be no end to these kinds of shenanigans. We'll be allowed to great deal of lack of clarity, and it would permit effectively an executive to sign the contract and then walk out of it based upon communication later to just try to enforce what the executive agreed to pay. Unless the court has further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Cash, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds for rebuttal if you'd like.
Very quickly, possible judge, quick question. The case of Scott v. Barnett doesn't contain any of those factors. With respect to the addendum, I would like to point out again that no claim existed, and that if that an executor pursuant to 2117.37 cannot waive presentation of a claim, and if it allows a claim that doesn't even exist and cannot be presented, it can't do that. In order to for the court to rule in favor of the bank, this court has to overturn Morris versus Continental Insurance Company case, and it also has to do away with the logic of the Miller versus Ewing case, as well as Scott v. Barnett. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cash. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.